This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hi, and welcome to The Best of Alberta. I'm Rod Kurtz. Every week, we're looking for Alberta stories that reflect what's happening right now in the province, and we pick the very best material from our morning and afternoon shows in Calgary and Edmonton. So hang with me for the next half hour. I'm sure you'll enjoy. It's been a huge discussion in the province in recent weeks. Oil royalties. Premier Ed Stelmach finally making his royalty announcement. John Archer will tell us about the proposed changes and have reaction for us. Brett the Hitman Hart, former professional wrestler, lives in Calgary. He's just released his new book, Hitman, My Real Life in the Cartoon World of Wrestling. We'll hear both parts of a two-part interview with CBC Calgary's Jeff Collins. And schools aren't only about reading, writing, and arithmetic today. Now they're also about daycare. Lydia Neufeld will have that story coming up on Best of Alberta.
Wrestling was never my dream, and all too often it was my nightmare. Yet ingrained in me from birth was the instinct to defend it like a religion. For as long as I can remember, my world has been filled with liars and bullshitters, losers and con men. But I've also seen the good side of pro wrestling. To me, there's something beautiful about a brotherhood of big, tough men who only pretend to hurt one another for a living instead of actually doing it. I came to appreciate that there is an art to it. In contrast to my father, who loved to proudly tell people who the really tough guys or shooters of his generation were, I can just as proudly tell you who the great workers or pretenders of my generation were. Unlike so many wrestlers with their various made-up names and adopted persona, I was authentic, born Bret Hart into a wrestling world I couldn't escape. I can't say life's been easy, but I can say it's been interesting.
There aren't too many Calgarians, or Canadians for that matter, who don't know at least a little bit about the Hart family dynasty and about Bret Hart's rise to become a world-famous pro wrestler. Bret was the son of legendary Calgary wrestling promoter Stu Hart. Bret retired from professional wrestling several years ago, and he's now written a warts-and-all book about his life, his career, and his family. It's called Hitman, My Real Life in the Cartoon World of Wrestling. Here is part one of Bret Hart's chat with Jeff Collins, the host of CBC Calgary's Homestretch.
The book, we're sort of looking for a unifying theme in the book. What comes through is it really is, it's all about family, both in the conventional sense, the Hart family, and in the sense of the wrestling family. Was that deliberate? Is that what you started out to do?
I think so, because like you said, it's probably that's the only family I ever really knew. And, I know they're different, like the one growing up. But I think we were all, even that family, the Hart family, was connected, always connected to the bigger pro wrestling family that was our life, all the same.
Talk to me about the first chapters are about growing up in the Hart household, right? A dozen kids. Take me inside the big red brick house. Where did you fit in the pecking order of the family?
Well, I think probably where I was placed in the family has a lot to do with maybe how I succeeded and the reasons why I succeeded in the family. I think there was five older boys first. And I had two sisters after that, and then I came, and then it's girl boy after that down to Owen. But I was surrounded by the girls in a family where I would have been the sixth boy, constantly doing everything he can to run herd with the five older brothers who were not always the they were always pretty rough housing kind of big brothers and got themselves in their own mess and trouble most of the time. But I think for me, I was like always jumping up and looking for that same rub. And it wasn't always maybe the best way to – I think it was tough sometimes having the five older brothers and trying to follow in their footsteps and at the same time having the two sisters between us. And there was naturally, it was going to be a lot of dog-cat kind of relationship with your sisters and brothers that way, where, sort of an ongoing sort of struggle trying to get attention in that family was even just being a middle kid was, you know, there's a lot to be said for that in that family. And you're always following the footsteps of all your brothers in so many different ways.
So when you say you were always, you know, you're always looking for that rub, you wanted the rub from your dad or you wanted the attention from your older brothers?
Well, I think all of us always in our own way, we'll always try to emulate earn the respect of my father, whether it was amateur wrestling or even, say, a fight at school or, you know, even just wrestling. I can remember my dad at the house on Sunday nights, we'd watch Bonanza. You know, I remember the theme music was a big thing. We'd all run in and we'd all sit on the couch and probably be a black and white TV in those days. But then he'd, you know, he put the little ones to bed. But, you know, we all, you know, in a lot of ways, I saw my dad as Lorne Greene and Little Joe and all those. They were all my brothers. It was a real connection between the boys in that family. And, you know, and my brothers were all pretty athletic, pretty competitive. And it was, you know, I don't know if it comes across well enough in my book, but we were all, I think, in our own way, tried to earn the respect of my father.
You know what comes across in the book is you loved your dad. And by the time I got to know your dad at all, he was old and he had nowhere near the intimidating presence that he must have been as a younger man. And you're frank in the book about you look back on it now from our generation and go, this was abusive treatment. But it's funny to listen to the two sides of the book. I mean, it must have made it tough.
I think the way I've written about my father, you know, some people can misinterpret that a little bit, and I think my dad would feel comfortable with what I've written about him, and I don't think that I think he knew all too well himself that there was a necessity on his part to, in raising 12 kids, is in a whole different scale than most parents could even remotely. Try to connect to. I mean, it was just – it was a tough time for him business-wise, and he went through a lot of hard, stressful times where if you knew my father, he had a resilience and a strength about him through all that. And he never – I never ever saw my dad weak or defeated. He was always somebody that was confident and always knew tomorrow would be a better day. And he was an optimist in a lot of ways, and I think we all admired that about him.
But you grew up – I mean I think this will surprise a lot of Calgarians too, but you grew up in a poor family, maybe because there were 12 kids. But even while Stampede Wrestling, you know, was the going concern that it was, there were tight times in this family.
Yeah, I don't think wrestling was anywhere near as – it wasn't as profitable as people might have hoped or thought. We always had a sort of an illusion that we were – we had a sort of feign that we were doing better than we were, and that I can remember going to school with ripped knees in my pants and being on some pretty tough times. We all sort of had a dignity about it, and I think we all got all that. We got that strength, I think, from my father, and I think how I've portrayed my father in my book, I hope that various siblings and people that knew him and loved him will in the end applaud how truthful this account of that life was.
Do you want your kids to feel the same way about you that you feel about Stu, about your dad?
Sure. I'd be honored if I hope that they can look up to me in the same that same light. I think my kids certainly have a higher regard for their grandfather as it is, and I hope that in reading this book that. You know, my kids and a lot of my nieces and nephews and even my brothers and sisters will appreciate it and actually get a good sense of melancholy about a lot of the things. I feel there's a lot of really fun parts of this book that they'll really enjoy, and I hope that I don't ruffle a lot of feathers with it.
Thank you very much. Good to see you.
My pleasure.
And coming up in about 13 minutes, we'll have part two of our interview with Brett, the Hitman Hart. Starting in 2009, oil and gas companies in Alberta are going to have to pay more in royalties. Recently, Premier Ed Stelmach took the wraps off one of the most anticipated government decisions in decades. By the year 2010, the government expects to take in an additional $1.4 billion in royalties from the energy sector. That's less than what was suggested by a government-appointed panel. John Archer covers the Alberta Legislature for CBC Radio, and he crunched the numbers with Ron Wilson, the host of Edmonton AM.
What other changes in the royalty scheme will Albertans see?
Well, the Alberta government is actually going after more money from oil sands operations in particular. Now, right now, companies in the oil sands pay a 1% royalty before recovering their development costs. Well, that's now going to be put on a sliding scale, and it could go as high as 9% if oil hits $120 a barrel. Now, the amount paid out after recovering their costs or the post-payout term, that rate is going up as well. Currently, the amount sits at 25% of profits. That's going on a sliding scale as well. All of this tied to the price of a barrel of oil. It could go as high as 40% at $120 a barrel.
So it goes up as the value of the barrel of oil goes up.
Exactly. And we'll put it this way. Right now, in the oil patch, the terms might be 1% and 25%, depending on where a company is at in its lifespan. At today's price for oil, they'd be sitting at roughly 5.5% to 6% pre-payout and 33% post-payout. And then over on the conventional oil and gas side, those royalties will also be put on sliding scales, and the increased government take will go up on both of those industries as well. But the lower producing gas wells will actually see a cut in royalties, while the higher royalties will actually be paid by higher producing wells.
And John, as you took a look at the government projections about the increased royalty revenue, can you compare that for us with what the Royalty Review Panel had recommended?
Right. The dollar value is estimated to be an additional $1.4 billion in the year 2010. Now, that would be a 20% increase over what's expected for 2010. Now, the Royalty Panel wanted the government to bring in an extra 20% in royalties as well, but those were based on 2006 numbers. The panel's expectation for 2010 was actually a 26% increase, or about almost $1.9 billion. So it's a little bit of a drop-off there. The government has lowered the amount that is expected, but Premier Ed Stelmach believes that his package has achieved a balance.
The new royalty framework will take effect January 1st, 2009. It gives industry time to make changes that are necessary. We'll see changes in price. And remember, as price goes down, our royalties go down. But on the upside, all Albertans will share in the reward if prices go up. So it's the balance, I believe, that industry was looking for and Albertans.
So, John, the Premier says this is the balance the industry was looking for. Is it?
Not so much. In talking to them throughout the day yesterday, the oil and gas industry has been lobbying hard for lower reductions ever since Our Fair Share, the Royalty Review Panel's report, came out in September. Pierre Alvarez is the president of the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. He is discouraged by the announcement that was made, but not as discouraged as he would have been if the review panel's report was adopted in its entirety.
The government did not accept all of the panel recommendations on the oil sand side. There were some features that we thought were extremely negative in terms of their tax treatment, so we're glad to see those aren't forward. There's a delay of a year or 14 months till those take effect. I think that is significant. But you can't take away from the fact that you now have added a significant increase to the front-end risk associated with these projects by the new royalty scheme that's been introduced by the government.
And Alvarez believes that the new regime will lead to a bit of a slowdown in the sector, but he says it's far too early to estimate just how severe it might be.
Okay, so those are the big producers, if you will, in the oil patch. John, you've reported a lot about some of the smaller companies, particularly on the natural gas side, who are really worried about the government decision. What are they telling you?
Well, I talked to Dave Yeager yesterday. He runs a service company out of Calgary that deals largely in the natural gas fields. He's also the former publisher of Roughneck magazine. He's been in the sector for 20, 25 years. He says that the slowdown in the natural gas fields is probably going to get worse, so expect more layoffs and fewer projects moving ahead. He estimates that the best that can be hoped for next year in the sector is to maintain this year's drilling rate, which is quite low compared to recent years. I also talked to Gary Leach, and he's the president of the Small Explorers and Producers Association, and he says the government is just trying to get too much from those higher producing wells.
The take from the conventional and gas sector is pretty severe. You need some good wells to pay for the poor wells and the dry holes, and the new royalty regime is going to have too much of a take going on the middling and good wells that you need to pay for the bad ones. So we're disappointed at how the government has structured the speed at which they increase their take from those kind of wells.
John, the Premier had also been pushed from the other side of the debate to increase royalty rates substantially. What are people on that side of this equation saying?
Well, Alberta Liberal leader Kevin Taft is talking about how the Premier is ignoring the issue of the loss of billions of dollars in recent years. NDP leader Brian Mason calls this a royalty regime that fails to capture the full value of the resource for Albertans. And Jaisal Vaghdama of the Pembina Institute puts it clearly. He thinks industry won.
They're basically continuing on getting the lion's share of the profits from development, particularly in the oil sands. Albertans aren't getting that fair share, and that means that industry is getting more than their fair share. And that's obviously a victory for industry in terms of the lobbying efforts that went on over the last few weeks, and is probably something that they're quite pleased about.
And Vaghdama says that those lobbying efforts kind of cast a pall over how the Stelmach government may operate in the future. When you think back to what happened over the past 5 weeks, a government-appointed panel released a report. Oil and gas companies were invited to meet with the deputy premier to plead their case. And in the end, the government watered down the recommendations from its own panel.
So what will the premier do now, John?
He's got a sell job to do. He has to sell this plan to Albertans. He has to sell it to party members, and that job starts immediately. There's a policy convention in Calgary through the weekend.
John, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Ron.
For many elementary schools in Edmonton, it's no longer just about providing an education. The schools are now finding they also need to provide before and after school care for their students. And they say it's just a sign of the times. CBC's Lydia Neufeld has the story.
Claudia, would you like some pickles?
Yes, please.
It's 3:45 p.m., and that means snack time for these kids who've just finished a full day of reading, writing, and arithmetic. While the rest of Rio Terra School is virtually empty, this one large classroom is bustling. The 21 children here are part of the after-school daycare. It's a contracted-out service that parents pay for.
This service allows the parents to drop their children on the way to work, and the children can stay here and be picked up, you know, anytime after 5 o'clock.
J.R. Garzon, the principal at Rio Terra School, says having the daycare is a huge benefit to the school. In the past, the school has struggled with low enrollment and even been threatened with closure. Garzon says some parents choose the school specifically because it provides before and after school care.
Just to give you a little perspective, 21 students represents basically a class to us. So that's one class of students that perhaps we would not have. This is a large building, and therefore at registration enrollment is important to be able to maintain the school as a viable place for the community. So definitely is a huge benefit because we are keeping those kids that may not necessarily come to our school as a result of, you know, if they didn't have the daycare.
At Holyrood Elementary School, it's a different situation. There is no daycare at the school.
We have a number of families who have found themselves in situations that, you know, truly are desperate in terms of child care.
Holyrood principal Rod Kostuk figures the lack of before and after school care at Holyrood is almost at a crisis. A booming economy means more families have both parents working. Kostuk worries that will result in more and more children being left to fend for themselves.
It's generally an uncomfortable feeling that we are beginning to develop about the situation. Is it critical yet? Nothing has come to our attention that says children are at risk, but we would have to believe that there are children who are finding themselves at risk, being unattended for a period of time while parents are off at work. I think the potential there for some real problem and difficulty is just waiting to happen for us.
The school has stepped in to help parents who are really stuck. Occasionally, two or three kids are dropped off at the school office before school begins for staff to watch. Some are also in the office after school. And while attracting students is not a problem for Holyrood right now, not having childcare available has cost the school in terms of enrollment. Kostuk says at least 9 families that had registered their children at Holyrood pulled out after not being able to find childcare in the neighborhood.
The problem is the school doesn't have any space available that could be renovated and leased for use as a daycare. So Kostuk is looking at the possibility of a partnership to build something.
We're just investigating the sources of funding. We're investigating who are the agencies that would support such a venture. Can we determine and legitimize that the need is as great as we see that it is, and we certainly think it will be, and there begin to build a case at some levels of government for the funding that we believe will be very much needed to make things work for us here.
Kostuk says the role of schools over the years has changed, and providing before and after school care for students is now essential.
The demands of families are tremendous, and for us to be able to provide that service for students allows that continuity of education, if you wish. No, it's not the school classroom, but it is within an educational environment, and certainly secures the well-being and I think the safety of kids at the same time. It goes a long way, I'm sure, to easing stress on a family, knowing that their children are being well cared for at a particular location rather than the guesswork that may be involved.
And the numbers would seem to support the idea that elementary schools and daycares are a good combination. In both public and Catholic schools in Edmonton, more than a third offer childcare. In Edmonton, I'm Lydia Neufeld.
Well, I hear music like this and I can envision a pro wrestler strutting into the ring with pyrotechnics blasting off behind him. Well, for many years, that was the life of Bret Hart, former professional wrestler Bret Hart. He's Calgary-born. He was a world-famous pro wrestler with the then WWF, World Wrestling Federation, which of course is now WWE. Bret's been retired for many years, but he's finally released a book about his life and career. It's called Hitman, My Real Life in the Cartoon World of Wrestling. Bret Hart is one of the sons of the late Stu Hart, the legendary promoter of Stampede Wrestling back in the 1960s. When Bret's dad was in charge of the ring, fighters came in all shapes and sizes, big pot-bellied guys, small guys, wiry guys. But when the WWF became popular, Hart and his colleagues all started to look like bodybuilders. And as Bret Hart writes in his book, the steroids helped that a lot. And that's where we pick up part two of Jeff Collins' conversation with Bret the Hitman Hart.
Talk to me about the impact of drugs on your profession, because in the book, the decision to use steroids because of the nature of that sport, right, because there was so much show business in it, is pretty much – it's a necessary evil, right? Is it still looked that way in wrestling, or do people have a higher regard now for the damage steroids can do to you?
I don't know anymore. I fear sometimes, and I don't know the pros and cons of it, that there's a, you know, that the wrestlers maybe, and a lot of athletes today are performing with human growth hormone and things of that nature, mm-hmm. and different drugs. And I don't know what the final verdict is on that, and whether there's a worse than steroids, or, you know, you're dealing with something on a whole different scale. You know, I'd hate to see a lot of wrestlers find out years from now that those things are even worse.
But what about – I mean, I bring up the murder-suicide of Chris Benoit, because I would think that would be – that would be like Ben Johnson in track and field, right? That – you think
well,
that would
I
really
think it's
stop
a,
things
I think
and hold.
It, I think it's a real mistake for anyone to really honestly think that they can pin Chris Benoit's – that whole tragedy. And it was being conveniently done where it's being pinned on steroids. But anyone mm-hmm. with any real brains would tell you that – it was something far more complicated than that. I don't think steroids, I'm not defending them. I don't think they're necessary. I don't think they need them. But in the end, steroids are basically a muscle builder. You know, they don't make you go nuts and kill people. Mm. And I have, like I said on Larry King, I think somebody needs to prove that. They should, if they can prove or connect in any way that not only a lot of the deaths in wrestling, from heart attacks and things of that nature, which may in fact be related to steroids and needs to be addressed, that someone can prove that and say, okay, now we have a definitive scientific answer to this. But right now there's too many people just saying, oh, we'll just pin it on steroids. Steroids are bad, but they're not the kind of thing that bring a lot of violent crime, I don't think.
Talk about the family of wrestlers, because I find the way you describe them in the book, you know, con men, guys who were putting on a great show, who would pretend to go out and hurt each other every single night, and yet love each other at the same time. This, I mean, where did you see that line between competition and camaraderie when you're on the road with a wrestling show?
Well, you know, the truth is in wrestling, you know, I've made this comparison before, but in a lot of ways, pro wrestling is more like figure skating in the sense that it's not two wrestlers, you know, physically punishing each other the way it often looks. It's two wrestlers that are supporting each other and holding each other up like a figure skater might hold one of his
partners.
Yeah. And there's no benefits or pensions or there's, you know, even when you worked for my father, generally if you got hurt, you were out of business, you know, and you might make a promoter might try to help you out for a few weeks, but you really weren't allowed to get hurt. Actually, whoever's fault it was your tough luck in the end of it. And that was, and even in later on in the big time WWF, it's the same thing. You could not afford, now that you were finally doing well, you couldn't afford to blow your knee out or hurt your neck or have somebody slam you wrong. And that happened all the time. And so I learned, always knew and understood right from the very, very beginning in wrestling that it was my responsibility as a brother of this family to protect my brother in the ring. And that builds for a lot of trust and respect and camaraderie that isn't necessarily transparent to people watching the TV show. Mm-hmm. And for me, another important thing that I always thought was important that people understand is that, you know, they say championship belts and winning, he's going to win the world title. Like, what does it mean? It's all pretend and somebody's just, you know, you've just been picked to become the champion. It doesn't work like that. There's a – when you were the champion, or at least when I was champion, that was the highest paying spot on the card. You were the highest paid star in the company. And there was an honor to that because basically you had to have all your contemporaries or your peers want you there to say, yeah, you are the star of the company and we're behind you. And I think, you know, like I say, I look back on matches where I had to lose a title and give the title to lose to somebody you had no respect for. And you knew that was not a team player and he's not going to look out for the rest of the team. But you have to do as you're told sort of thing. And then there's other guys you go, you know, somebody that has earned it and really deserves this break and you're passing that torch. And he's going to get your money spot and you're going to take a step down. You're going to make less – starting tomorrow, you make less money than you were today. But there's an honor in that and there was a certain pride that goes beyond what people sort of normally understand about wrestling. That in a lot of ways, winning and losing wrestling belts in my era was as real as John Elway losing the Super Bowl.
Yeah. How old are you now?
I'm 50.
Are you a happy 50-year-old?
Yes, I think I am, yeah. Happy today anyway.
That's sometimes as much as you can hope for, my friend, every single day. Thank you very much. Good to see you.
My pleasure.
Certainly was, and hope you enjoyed it. That wraps up this edition of Best of Alberta from CBC Radio, program only available via internet download or podcast. If you'd like to comment on anything you've heard, you can connect with us online. Just go to cbc.ca, then click on Contact Us on the left side of the screen. Look forward to hearing from you. Have a great week. I'm Rod Kurtz.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.